Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 3. Now, how much damage had this rather frightening raid, this part of the Baedeker raids, how much damage had it actually done in Exeter and in the your locality?
Well, in the immediate locality of where we lived, there was comparatively little damage. Our house, as I say, had told you, had a window blown out and some panes of glass broken, and I guess some tiles removed. Oh, there's one significant to me. We had a garage door, the front door led out past the garage, and the garage was to one side. And the garage door was made of panels about 3 foot, 2 foot, 6 foot wide, all linked together. And on these panels were slats of wood, and overlapping like a fence laid in a horizontal plane of flanks, and they were all stacked, obviously overlapped, one after the other. And one of the bombs, the blast must have hit this garage roof, and all the bits of timber forming these slats all blew up in the air, and they all came down one at a time, so that the noise of these falling slats was, and we wonder what on earth it was, because nobody visualized that happening. We thought, well, what monstrous bomb or thing have the Germans dropped on, you know, to cause that to happen? So when it was all over, we went outside, and there were all these bits of timber lying around the place. We realized what we had heard. So that was intriguing and perhaps a bit worrying at the time, but the noise of these bombs and the blast and the vibrations was really quite frightening.
And how much, so locally, your house was one of the worst damaged.
Well, it was slightly damaged, yeah.
In the area. What about in the main town?
Well, in the town, the whole centre of Exeter had been set alight. And this Bedford Circus that I previously mentioned was completely razed to the ground. When we went down the next day or a day or two later, the fires were still, you know, the buildings were still on fire. And we got let into the, because we knew one of the, well, the wardens on duty, he let us go in to look at the site of the old office. And it was, what had been this most elegant building was just a pile of rubble, and was still red hot. I mean, it was blistering heat, and the caretaker had a pile of coke coal down in his basement, and that was still red hot. You could just see this outline of this pile of coke or coal or whatever, red hot. And the nameplate of the office I worked in, R.M. Challis and Son, was on the front, near the front door, and that had fallen off and was lying in the gutter. And I retrieved this brass, bent, buckled, burnt brass plate and took it to the office when this Mr. Challis, who ran the business, when he found some other temporary accommodation, which we were in, they were in for quite a long time afterward. But I gave him this brass plate, and he had it refurbished and used again, which I was very proud to be able to retrieve that one. And particularly as there was an unexploded bomb in the in the middle of this green where the air raid shelters were, this warden let us in. Even though the unexploded bomb hadn't exploded, which was, if it had, you know, it had exploded, that would have been the end of the story, because with this smouldering ruins all around, there wouldn't have been a hope in hell of getting out. Anyway, it didn't go off, and I did get the brass plate, and I was very, very pleased to have done that. But the whole of Exeter, the main town part, city part, was completely burnt out. The cathedral was was spared, saved, so that didn't have any material damage, any great damage. He must have had some superfluous damage. But he must have had some damage, but it was nothing very serious, because it was spared. It wasn't set on fire. Whether the fire watchers managed to deal with any fire bombs, I don't know. But there was no damage done to the cathedral. But all around, the cathedral was burnt down.
What was morale like? Did people worry about them coming back, as having happened once?
Yes. Thereafter, for some time afterwards, every night there would be people going up past our house towards the woods, Stoke Woods, I think they were called, and they would have blankets and baskets with thermoses and so on. They would spend the night in the woods, getting out of the town, just in case there was another raid.
There wasn't, was it?
No, there wasn't. Not seriously.
How long did they keep it up?
Oh, I don't remember, but for quite some, a couple of months, I would think.
And how about your family? How did they feel?
Relieved that there was no more damage. Very relieved to see Father come back, also having been on duty. Not as half as relieved as he was to see that we were still a family together and the house was still standing. He having had to report that bombs had been dropped in the Pennsylvania area. So that was a great relief to us all.
Now, having left school, did you stay in the Air Training Corps? Or did you then...
Yeah, yes.
Right. So, I wondered if... Did you leave school in 41 then? Or,
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what confused. So,
So you didn't join
the Home Guard?
No. My father persuaded me not to join the Home Guard. Said that.
Why? Because that's quite interesting.
Well, he thought being in the Air Training Corps was enough, and I certainly couldn't do both, so I'd had to leave the Air Training Corps to do Home Guard duty. I'm a bit sorry that I didn't have that added experience, but anyway, it didn't matter. But the great thing I want to tell you about the Air Training Corps was that. Because of the Air Training Corps and because of the school, they discovered that you could enter people for the University Air Squadrons. The University Air Squadrons were part of the universities before the war. And soon after the war started, they realized that there was a ready-made, already existing unit which could train aircrew. And they set up something called the University Short Course, where people in the ATC, I don't know whether that was an essential part, but certainly schools could enter, put forward names, to join the University Air Squadrons instead of going into the Air Force in the normal way. Now, when you went into the Air Force in the normal way, you joined up and you were sent to what was called an initial training wing, ITW. And this University Air Squadron, instead of lasting just 3 months like the ITWs, lasted for 6 months. Excuse me. Sorry. Lasted for 6 months and... covered the same syllabus of the initial training wings. So you had some people, young men, 17, you had to be 17 and a half, or between 17 and a half and 18 and a half, something like that. That was essential. And the same, so you had the University Air Squadrons churning out the end product of an ITW, and you had the ITWs themselves, which were, as you probably know, Torquay and Scarborough and Aberystwyth and places like that. They took over holiday, unused holiday houses for the ITW. So I applied to go to the University Short Course because several others from this ATC...
Now, when was this? When you were working or when you were at school?
When I was working. I'm going to cough again, sorry. No, whilst I was working, still a member of the ATC, and my name went forward to apply for this university short course. And you joined the university air squadrons. Now, Oxford and Cambridge and Belfast and London and Wales, all sorts of universities had these squadrons, none of which were quite as famous as the Oxford and Cambridge one. For example, Group Captain Cheshire was a member of the Oxford University Air Squadron before the war. So they produced, superb characters and pilots, and he was just one example. I didn't know that at the time, but I chose to go to Oxford, and I even more so chose to go to Exeter College, Oxford, because that's where my brother had been as a scholar. And again, to my delight, because I identified a place I wanted to go to, I got sent there. And
now, when was this?
That was in April 1944. April. I know it started in April, and it must be 1943.
That sounds more like.
Yep. Yeah, April 1943.
What did you have to go through? Any sort of interview process or testing?
Yes. Well, you had to have a recommendation from the school, the headmaster in particular. I think one of the questions he was asked, would have been asked, was, is this nominee does he do well at subjects he likes, or does he not do very well in subjects he does not like, and would this be a suitable, might he have gone to university but for the war? And that's where my headmaster must have had to cross his fingers and ask for divine guidance, because I doubt very much whether I should have gone to university. But when you went on the university short course, you did five days a week as an undergraduate and 2 days a week as being in the Air Force. So 2 whole days of the week were spent in uniform doing this ITW syllabus, which again was drill, quite a lot of drill. Navigation.
So when did you actually start?
I started in April.
That's when you actually started. Yes, so you'd applied before.
My service counted from January 1943, when I signed on and was put on the volunteer reserve, until called. And then April 1943, I went to Oxford University Air Squadron, which finished in 6 months after that. What was that? The October, November time.
Now, so what were you studying?
Well, I had to choose academic subjects, and I chose geography and history. And so we did university standard history and geography, which wasn't ever so difficult. I think the university air squadrons, when they started again during, in 1989, they chose to have only science-based students. And then shortly after, they discovered that they were missing out on recruiting perfectly eligible school leavers who had opted years ago to take arts subjects. And they suddenly realised they were excluding those people, let's say, like Group Captain Cheshire, who was not necessarily a scientist.
Now, we'll do that. How did you do it? It's only for 6 months, but how did you do academically? Now doing subjects you like.
I chose subjects I liked. I chose subjects I thought I could cope with, and all I can tell you is that I coped. We had to do an essay every week, one essay a week, and we had one tutorial face-to-face with a college professor or lecturer or Don or whatever he was called, and he would recommend half a dozen books that you had to refer to, and you had to get them. And I used to conscientiously work every morning. I was there at reading these books and assimilating this history or geography or whatever. I found the geography much more interesting than the history, I must admit. But I certainly wouldn't say I excelled at it in any way, but I coped.
And where were you living? We'll come to the area.
We lived in college.
In the normal?
Normal, yeah. I lived in an Exeter college in room 5, staircase 11 or something like that.
And what were the rooms like? Were you just normal student?
Yeah, normal student. And I had a room to myself. So I had a room and a bedroom off. And, of course, there were no wash basins or whatever. In those days, you had a china bowl and a jug. That was your washing facilities. So you had a bedroom and a study. And you were treated just like a normal undergraduate. You had to wear an undergraduate's gown, which was a little short-arsed thing, unless you were a scholar when you had a full-length one. I've got a diagram of it in the memoirs I'm trying to write. Sometimes you had to wear a uniform and a gown, which was pretty odd, but because if you came straight off the university air squadron duty day and you had to go to a tutorial, you hadn't got time to change, so you just put this gown on. And nobody thought it was funny. I did, but nobody, you know, it was the thing, the done thing. And so you had this one-to-one tuition with a professor, Don, and he'd set you an essay to write, and we had one or two lectures, sometimes one a day, I suppose, from the same sort of people on the subject of either history or geography. I think why we changed halfway from history to geography was that when we went up in April, the whole college or the whole university closed down at the end of that term, and we had to stay on there, so they had to find something for us to do. And the geography tutors were still in residence, and so they, part of their war work, I guess, was to try and teach deadbeats like me something about the subject.
How did you get on with the normal students? You know what I mean?
Yes, the other students who were there got on very well with them, because we were treated just like any other student, and we did all the other student-like things. My advice from my brother was to join everything, mix in with everything. So I went to political meetings, religious meetings, nondescript meetings just for the sake of meetings. So I went to them all and tried to acquire whatever knowledge there was to be acquired at the university.
Now, what about your RAF training with the University Air Squadron? Now, so how did that start? Well, firstly, the uniform. Was it the same as your air?
No, you got issued with a real proper uniform with the tunic and collar and tie and all that stuff, which was the ATC buttoned up to the neck like a battle dress, but before battle dress. But the University Air Squadron, you had proper uniform. Everything except your own, you wore your own shoes, you didn't get issued with shoes or boots. That came later. So we paraded, and the only difference was that we had, instead of having RAF buttons, we had University Air Squadron buttons. But I wore the same uniform when I finally, or the day when I finally reported to the RAF proper. And I just changed the buttons.
So how did they start you on your training programme? They've got you for, 6 months?
Yes.
6 or 7 months. How do they start their training? You know, they've got you for 2 days a week.
Yes.
So what do they do?
Well, I've forgotten the actual beginning, but it's quite clear that the University Air Squadron day started at 7 o'clock in the morning with PE, but it was awful easy PE, you know. At 17 and a half, just no bother at all. So
you were still fit from your rugby days?
Well, very fit, yes. And thereafter got fitter and fitter, I suppose.
What kind of stuff were they doing?
Yes.
arms bend
and running around and jumping over things and press-ups and just the normal PT that we'd been doing for years at school. So that started the day, and then we went back to college for breakfast, and then back again at let's say 0900, and we had a series of lectures throughout the day on these same old subjects, but the navigation was much more advanced.
And what were you covering now then?
Well, the same sort of pattern of getting from A to B, but they speeded up the process. You were under some pressure to do it in a fixed time, and the more you did it, the quicker you got at it, and so on. But the chaps who hadn't done much time in the ATC really struggled, whereas I found it comparatively easy, or straightforward anyway. For example, that this Morse business, I hadn't realised how comparatively good I was at Morse code until I started. We had not only to receive the Morse code, we had to send it as well. And I was sending it on the lamp. And I remember the sergeant instructor at the university air squadron saying, right, I want you to do this, you know, every time there's a signal every time there's a signal session on the program, I want you to do the oldest lamp. So I spent my time flashing this oldest lamp because I got the knack of it. Oh, and one of the things we did on this university air squadron was clay pigeon shooting.
I've heard this before. Tell me about that. If you could explain the whole thing you were doing.
Yeah, well, we didn't do much rifle firing. Just lying on your tummy firing a rifle at a target. I don't remember doing any of it at this stage. But we had this ability to go to an estate just outside Oxford, and it was run by a Colonel Fennel. And they felt this Fennel with two F's. And he was a strange guy. Breeches and gaiters and a hunting style cap and a colonel's idea of discipline. So he barked at you a fair bit. And he showed you how to load and whatever, the shotguns which he provided, and had somebody pulling this gadget which fired the clay pigeon. Well, none of us, very few of us, had done anything like this before. And I, for some reason or other, caught on the idea. I've got a cough again, sorry. Much shooting at all. I had an air gun at home and so on, but I'd certainly not done any of this clay pigeon shooting. And I was absolutely hopeless to begin with. But I quite suddenly, if you like, got hold of the idea, twigged what it was all about, and I became quite good at it.
Now, is this the business? Because what you learn is deflection shooting.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So you have to shoot ahead. Is that what you learned? I mean, can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, just that. You suddenly, because he was a clever teacher, I suppose, and very anxious that we should acquire some ability. And not all did, but as I say, I got the knack of it, of allowing deflection so that your shot and the clay pigeon met in the right place. And he tried all sorts of tricks of firing across and towards you, and when you were not completely prepared for it. So you know, he knew what he was about, and he was a crusty old creature, but he was devoted several days a week, I suppose, to just teaching these strange guys how to shoot clay pigeons. And subsequently, we did it in flying training school. It's the only thing I ever won any money ever won any money at, because we'd have a little sweepstake as to who could shoot most clay pigeons down, and because I had acquired the knack, I found myself winning a few quid or a few dollars. As I said, the only thing I've ever won money at. But so I acquired that. So we did that. And we also did this air experience business. We got taken up in the squadron's Tiger Moths.
That may be a flight you do remember.
Yes, and I remember it because it was unexciting. There's nothing much happened. I mean, stooging around. It's just like being taken out in somebody has a new car and they want to show you their new car, so they drive you around. Well, it's not very exciting. Well, it was just a bit like that. We flew over the countryside, but at least we found out what it was like to be in the air, and to be in the air in a cockpit with the wind whistling past your ears, and so that was no longer off-putting. We didn't learn any navigation because we didn't go that far or fly for that long, because we only had the University Air Squadron only had one, probably maybe two, but certainly only one often, Tiger Moths. So they had to go up through these there must have been several hundred of us on the squadron at the time, and so the old turn didn't come round very often, but at least we got taken into the air, and so we knew that we weren't going to be air sick, we weren't going to be shit scared, we weren't going to be paralytic or speechless or whatever. You know, we knew what it felt like, which must have been a great asset when we finally started flying.
But there's no question of starting to teach to fly. This is just purely experience.
Purely air experience. Being taken up and driven around in the air.
Now, anything else, though, so you've got all the stuff you did at, I presume, the ATC, so you've got meteorology, aircraft recognition, were you doing all that as well?
Yes.
Anything new other than the clay pigeon and the air experience flight?
Yes, the anti-gas business, which was a bit of a formality. We got anti-gas, we got told about the gases that might be used and what to do about it and so on. And we were told that every airfield or Air Force unit would have a gas, I've forgotten what they call them, but it was a shower set up so that if you got covered in mustard gas, there were showers where you'd go in and they were equipped to wash this stuff off you.
So although gas hadn't been used in that war, they were still taking it seriously,
yes. And even, you know, in the Air Force, you can understand that perhaps in the Army, but even in the Air Force we were taught it and had to pass an exam in it. And we had exams all the way along the line at the squadron, this two-day-a-week business. I guess we had an exam once a week. And if you didn't pass, and it's not say just one, but if you failed several, you just weren't seen thereafter. They quietly got rid of you. You went back. You got the sack. You got pushed out. You went back home.
Did that happen to many people?
Yes. I've no idea how many, in as much as a percentage, but the people who were not prepared to knuckle down, accept the discipline, and the discipline of the work, actually, rather than the discipline of anything else. So, because you had to do the university stuff, and you had to do the Air Force stuff, and you had an Air Force test or exam once a week,